Catherine.
Hello, Nina.
How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm okay, but we're going to talk about pain today.
Pain. Yes.
I'm sorry to say.
Economic pain, something you and I know a great deal about.
Exactly. So we have called this episode The Cinema of Economic Pain because we want to talk about cinema, meaning movies, mm-hmm. that for various reasons we think there are fantastic movies that talk about moments of when caca hits the fan. In other words, there's a major change of ownership or an economic turmoil of some sort that creates an enormous amount of pain to everybody participating, willingly or not.
Right.
We have just found examples for a long list of movies that at the end I can read them as sort of for further watching.
Right. I just want to say that part of this was inspired by the fact that you did a wonderful collection of movies and documentaries for the Going Direct Reset for the 2020 annual wrap-up. And that was what inspired us to look at movies about gut-wrenching economic change.
Right. So right. The list, the full list is indeed, as you say, a list of movies that are dealing with big economic or political changes. And it's in its full extent available for subscribers for the Solari Report. But we just wanted to talk about a few movies, documentaries and features that capture those moments in history that describe this total change of, let's say, ownership or economic situation of
right.
many people.
Right.
So to keep to our format, why don't you start with the first movie and then we can alternate and talk about them a little bit. And hopefully they will be the movies that our listeners are not even familiar with.
Well, I wanted to start with Barbarians at the Gate. It was originally a book and was made into a TV movie for HBO. And it's about the takeover war of that occurred between RJR and Nabisco. And I was right in the middle of it in a very tangential role because RJR had been a longtime Dylan Reed client on Wall Street. And it was always amazing because they were always just pumping full of cash. And, you know, the cigarettes was a big cash cow business. They were a tobacco company. And RJR hired Dylan Reed to give the fairness opinion to the board. And the man, Dylan Reed, the partner Dylan Reed, who was in charge of the assignment, found the whole situation so frustrating he was said to have pulled his phone out of the wall and threw it into his glass window. I wasn't there.
Clearly, he had a frustration. Which year, more or less, we're talking about? Which era of economic history of the United States?
It was late 80s. And believe it or not, I've written about this deal in my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. So I wrote about RJR Nabisco because when the deal happened, so this is a movie about a takeover war involving two companies in Wall Street. It's a leveraged buyout proposal of RJR Nabisco. And the Ross Johnson, who was the president and CEO of RJR Nabisco, was unbelievably colorful and interesting. And this thing really got, you know, it involved a lot of Wall Street firms, it involved a lot of money. Now, what was interesting is that later on, much later on, the European Union sued RJR for money laundering with cigarettes. And the mystery on the LBO battle, and it ended up embroiling the first year of the Bush administration, you know, because I think the Bush administration finally just threw the deal for KKR. But so when the European Union came out with this lawsuit, what it did was it made it clear that we were looking at the mother of all money laundering networks.
Oh, gee.
And the reason the bidding war had gotten so out of hand was the actual cash of the company, you know, sort of the covert cash was much greater because the price kept going up, up, up. And we kept thinking, they'll never be able to pay back all this debt. How in the world is RJR supposed to pay back this debt? And yet, as soon as it was taken over by KKR, the debt got paid down very rapidly, and everybody was shaking their head saying, how does this make any sense? And then when the European Union filed the lawsuit, which is described in detail in the Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, we're all saying, ah, that's how they paid back all that debt. It's basically an organized crime war.
Huh.
It's pretty funny. Anyway, but this movie clearly doesn't get into the full backdrop, as most movies don't. But you see sort of a very funny, and there's a very famous, what's his name, the actor who plays Ross Johnson, very famous, I can't remember his name. Anyway, but it's sort of a fun description of one of these great Wall Street wars that did get very kind of heated and crazy. You know, it's kind of like 300 alpha males going crazy together. So it's in that sense a fun movie, but you see how you can get a situation where a series of people decide to engineer a change of control of a company, and the next thing you know, you're in the middle of all-out war.
James Garner, I just checked.
Yeah, James Garner. So I knew a series of people involved, and our firm was involved. And I'll tell you, I didn't understand what had really happened until I read the European Union lawsuit.
Well, it is fascinating then. But so this is an example of a change of ownership, if you like, at the level of one company, right? Or one business environment, if you like, or one industry.
Right.
That is fairly tremendous, right? Because it's...
Right. But here's the thing. The company gets turned into a football and you have people competing to buy it.
Love the metaphor.
So the company gets... You know, one bid triggers the company going on the auction block. And of course, then you've got the lawyers and the investment bankers piling on, and everybody sees an opportunity to make money from tearing up the company and refinancing the company. And, you know, the war is on. It's a real food fight when these things happen. And this one got wildly out of control.
Right. Which is why it ended up being described in a book and in the movie. Right, so this is at the level of one company. I want to do it to look at a change of ownership, if you like, at the level of geographical region, because not even one country, for which I have chosen the movie that is called Once Upon a Time in China, which is part of at least five movies directed by the same director called Hark Sui, but it has a hero and historical figure of someone who was a martial artist and who was portrayed in the movies many times. His name is Wong Fei-hung. He was kind of Cantonese ethnicity, if you like. And he was literally a hero of at least 100 films, martial arts films, because he was very popular kind of folk hero. This specific movie that was made in 1991 is presenting him as not only the martial arts master, he was also a doctor, but he was also a hero of the popular resistance, if you like, of the Chinese population of the southeastern border, if you like, or coast, against the invading forces of the Westerners. So it's the Americans, the British, the French, the Germans. There were missionaries, there was the army, there were merchants, traders. There was a whole encroachment of Western colonial forces, if you like, that were interested in this part of the coast, which is, you know, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Canton, and all these cities on the kind of southeastern coast. Towards the end of the 19th century, early the 20th, at the time the imperial court that fell in 1911 was quite weak. that were nominally the Chinese governor who was governing in the name of the palace of the Qing dynasty. The empress was called Cixi, and it was in her name that they were governing. But physically, China at the time did not have much to say in that region, just because the army was weak and the Western forces had a military power that they could not match. So this is kind of the setting of it. And the reason I found, not only this is a great movie to watch because it's a martial arts and to a great extent a comedy. So it's basically a Hong Kong entertainment film. It's very pleasant. Yes, there's five of them.
Oh, really? I didn't know it was a comedy.
Yeah, it's not very heavy. It's not a drama. If anything, it's an entertainment. It's martial arts, incredible martial arts scenes.
Uh-huh.
Wong Fei-hung is the hero of several very famous movies. The other one is The Drunken Master, where he's portrayed by young Jackie Chan. And The Drunken Master is one of the most famous Jackie Chan movies.
Right.
This one is directed by Tsui Hark, or Hark Tsui, depending in which order you want to say his name.
Wasn't this the one that really inspired the whole martial arts genre?
Well, this is one of them. This one stars Jet Li.
That's one of
his absolute prime. Jet Li himself was an accomplished martial arts master. So the level of skill, of martial arts skill that is shown in this movie is unsurpassed. It's wonderful to watch. And the fight sequences that are staged there, the history of cinema. So if anybody is into martial arts or Asian cinema or entertainment in general, this is one of the classic movies. But what this movie also portrays is the tremendous change of ownership that is happening, because obviously China was basically losing territory and power at a very rapid pace at that period between, let's say, Boxer Rebellion and the war of that started in 1937, the Sino-Chinese War.
Right.
So it is a very tumultuous period in the history of the region and a perfect example of, colonialism. Not, 17th, 18th century or, something very early on, which was happening when Europeans were embarking onto faraway trips like Christopher Columbus. This is happening at the turn of the 20th century and where the invading armies already have guns and ships and cannons. And there's no way, they're so technologically advanced in comparison with the land that they are invading that obviously this is a very uneven fight. China till this day is very sore at the West about that part of the history and the invasion. So it's an interesting kind of watching the colonialists in progress at the time when there were already photos, there was already advanced technology. So this is slightly different than watching, something that was happening, let's say, 17th century. But it's also a very enjoyable film, which I would highly recommend.
Right.
It's Jet Li doing martial arts, what's not to like? And there's five of them. So, there's something to watch, really, if someone is into those movies.
Right.
So that is my choice of a great illustration of when there is a lot of economic pain. What about your choice?
Okay, so my next choice is about economic pain brought about by financial shenanigans. So financial fraud. It's called Enron, the Smartest Guys in the Room, and it's a documentary. It was nominated for one of the best documentaries in, I think, 2006. It was based on a book by two Fortune reporters who did a lot of deep digging on the Enron scandal after, and published a lot, including after Enron failed. And this is a little bit like Barbarian in the Gate in that you certainly don't get the whole story. They're just skimming the surface. But the reason I chose it, and I think it's worth anybody watching, I did do a lot of deep diving on Enron, and it was astonishing the extraordinary lawlessness with which Enron ran their operation and what they got away with. But one of the things they did was they had an energy trading market that traded the California energy market and did a huge amount of damage, putting I don't know how many businesses out of business, but they literally engaged in criminality through the trading markets that ended up...
I still remember the blackouts in LA.
Yeah, that wreaked havoc over the California energy and power supply and put millions of people in real economic pain and jeopardy. And there is a scene in this documentary where they interview the young people who were involved in doing the trading and they play the tape. And you hear the pleasure they get out of essentially destroying honest businesses and doing it by criminal methods and how much fun they think it is. And it is a very interesting insight on the extent to which you can take young people and turn them into the equivalent of a drone operator who's killing people in criminal methods or, you know, across the line. And they literally treat it as though it's a Nintendo game.
Well, it's or like the children soldiers in Africa, right?
During exactly.
Wars, you know, you take someone very young and impressionable who doesn't understand what they are doing and just turn them into a killing machine,
right.
Either literally or economically in this case.
Right.
But, yeah.
It's just like that science fiction novel. I think it's Ender's Game. So, But it's a case study in psychopathy instituted by people who are clearly not psychopaths, but have been brought along to think that this is fun and fashionable. Anyway, so it's a very interesting case study in sort of one of the fact patterns that brings about enormous economic pain, particularly in the world we live in right now. And it's a sobering reminder of what is and can be. And I think that's a case study that's a sobering one to have in your back pocket during 2021.
Huh. Can you also talk about The Rogue Trader, about the Barings Bank? This is a feature film, not a documentary, but starring Ewan McGregor, but talks about the similar situation.
So Rogue Trader is an interesting story because it's another, you know, it's the same as the last Barbarians at the Gate and Enron at the smartest guys in the room, because it's the surface story. You don't get the real story. But you do pick up interesting pieces. Barings had just bought Dillon Reed. I was a partner and I exited to...
It's a bank, by the way. Let's just explain what Barings is or was.
Oh, I will. So Barings Bank was a very prestigious British bank and it had just bought my old firm, Dillon Reed, after I exited to go into the Bush administration. And what happened was there was a trader at Barings who engaged in unauthorized trades, and his book grew big, and it ended up bankrupting the entire Barings Bank. And of course, this is the worst nightmare for any Wall Street executive, that a trader is allowed to build up unauthorized positions. You don't catch it, and the next thing you know, because of the enormous losses that can occur in these markets, you can literally take down the bank. I used to have a partner at Dillon Reed who would, as soon as anybody made a profit, he'd come roaring. He had the accountant for the entire floor sitting in his office because he watched the numbers so carefully. And if anybody made a profit, he'd roar out and say, "You made a profit. Tell me why I'm so lucky." And he'd make him prove why there was a real profit, because the danger of one of these positions getting out of hand was so frightening. But you see the life of the young trader. Now, what I believe probably happened was that, you know, a whole bunch of other losses throughout the firm were sort of consolidated and moved into this guy's book so that, you know, when he went down, he took the blame for everything across the firm instead of just his unauthorized position. So that's just a guess.
What I know about finance would not fit in a thimble, but I was fascinated by the very fact that while I am talking in those movies about the change of ownership as a result of a war, a revolution, or something major, in the 20th century, thanks to, you know, digital trading and a lot of other technological changes, you can have one person who can actually bring down the entire venerated 200 years institution, or 300 years. I think Baring Banks was like 300 years old.
The movie you want to watch for the rogue trading kind of situation, where the Wall Street, you know, one trader or one firm can literally flip the entire global economy or set it into a downturn. The all-time best movie is Margin Call.
Right.
So if you haven't seen Margin Call.
Several times, yes. Amazing. Several times. I remember actually going to see this movie in a theater. I wanted to see it in a theater. And I went to some small art house movie and I was one of the 10 people in the cinema. And I was just saying, like, how is that possible? This is such an amazing film. But hey.
It's an amazing film. And there are so many great insights. There are so many moments. Sometime I would love to go watch that film with you and just, you know, we pause it and I tell you all sorts of great stories and insights about, it's amazing that they had some deep Wall Street advice to make that movie.
Maybe we should do a video segment on this. It is an amazing film. But that's what is scary to me, that I can understand when there is a change of ownership because the king and the queen have lost their heads and there's a French Revolution. But, you know, here you have just a guy with a computer terminal, right?
Right.
Terrifying. So a lot of economic pain, of course, because of that. My next film is a classic film about the tremendous political change that obviously is tied to the economic change. It's a Polish movie that a lot of people may not have seen it, but they should, because it is a great piece of cinema art. The title of the film is Men of Marble. And Man of Marble was directed by Andrzej Wajda, director of the older generation, who was famous in 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and has gotten an Oscar and was one of the great supporters of Solidarity and probably the most famous Polish director in the history of Polish cinema. The Man of Marble is a movie that is describing... The storyline is that there is we're in 1980s and there is this young female television documentalist who, for her graduation thesis at her film school, chooses to do a biography of a young hero of the 1950s Stalinist period, exceptional worker who was the hero of work, and he disappeared from the scene. Nobody knows what happened to him. So she searches through various pieces of documentary footage, old newsreels and documents, talks to his son, and discovers that the truth obviously is slightly more complicated. He was a bricklayer who believed in this propaganda of, you know, everybody is going to rebuild the country after the war. So he is going to lay bricks faster than anybody else. Soon, of course, what happens is that his fellow workers are not so happy about him imposing such a speed in building. And all this is basically a sham, a propaganda, so that everybody would look good in the newsreel. He is shunned and then he's injured. And what the story is, because we are now fast-forwarding to 1980s, where the communists as a regime is well-established in Poland and all the Eastern Bloc countries. And when she wants to say the truth that, you know, the whole thing about this incredible productivity of 1950s was a sham, nobody wants to, you know, to hear the truth, and the least of it, her sponsors, which are responsible to the governing Communist Party that basically makes all the decisions in a state-run economy. So this is the plot, and the film, when it was trying to be released, has encountered a lot of censorship problems. Eventually it became a movie that was kind of at the heart of the Solidarity movement. But when it was released prior to the Solidarity movement in 1970s, it was practically a movie that was almost banned. And we're talking here about this incredible change of ownership that happened after the Second World War, where a big chunk of Eastern Europe was taken over by the Soviet Union and turned into kind of satellite states that were providing, like colonies, basically, that were providing all the economic support for the Soviet Union. There was a division, you know, Germany and Czechoslovakia were producing heavy machinery and industrial goods. Poland was producing agricultural goods and so on and so on. So that change of the political regime resulted obviously in a tremendous economic change that people like the hero of this movie, the bricklayer, are made into heroes. And the people who are opposing the regime, especially if they were so-called bourgeois, then obviously they were, all the property was taken away from them. So all this is kind of underlying the whole story, meaning you have to remember this political economic change to understand what the story is about.
Right.
It is a very interesting film because it just shows the world that is not that familiar maybe to the Western viewer. And it is shown through the eyes of the young, energetic person who is also a woman filmmaker. So, you know, for the movie that is made in 1970s, is quite revolutionary. I mean, that didn't happen in the Western cinema for the next 20, 25 years. But it started, you know, somewhere else. It started in the Eastern Europe, that kind of outlook on maybe art of or women in films. I would really recommend this film for anybody who's interested in either the geopolitics of the region or this history of cinema.
So it also reminds me of the danger of buying the propaganda. When you're in a period of this kind of tremendous change, you need to listen and pay attention to what's going on around you and not get your map from the propaganda.
Well, that movie shows it quite well because it shows first the 1950s where the hero of this story, the bricklayer, buys into this propaganda 100%. You know, he believes in the ideals of workers' paradise. And then the woman who makes a documentary about him 30 years later in 1970s, and early, you know, towards the 1980s, is completely disillusioned. You know, she lives in a regime that is completely compromised from the moral point of view. And everybody is trying to shut down her movie because nobody wants to talk about the Stalinist period and all the promises that were never kept. You know?
Right.
So, yes, do not believe in propaganda that is launched in the name of ideals that, you know, the young people are extremely susceptible. But the two young heroes, because she's the same age as the person that she's doing a movie about, in 30 years of this propaganda, you know, she's of the generation, you know, of the young Poles in 1970s who the majority never believed in the propaganda anymore because they had their eyes. But, you know, it took 30 years of hardship, of economic pain, exactly.
Exactly. Okay, so let's turn to... The next one is a documentary that is not very well known, but I think it's a fascinating view. It's called The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And it's a documentary of what happened to Cuba when the Soviet Union collapsed and suddenly all of Cuba's foreign aid, including oil from Russia, stopped. And they had to go from industrial agriculture to organic agriculture overnight in a shock treatment. And it tells the story of the conversion that they made. And it's really, to me, the part that I find interesting is this conversion of the food system from one that's using fertilizer and tractors to one that's very organic and natural, because they just, you know, they can't afford the industrial version. And one of the things that happens is when the 2 years process is over, the most profitable people in Cuba are the organic farmers. They're making a ton of money. But needless to say, a tremendous number of people have learned how to grow food. And it's kind of the building of fresh food systems from shock treatment. The other thing it doesn't go into as much, but is important to understand, is Cuba has an incredible healthcare system. And it's a long and interesting story how the Cubans built it. And of course, it's a beautiful, Cuba is a beautiful island. Anyway, so these folks, when the tensions were still high between America and Cuba, but it's a very interesting case study on what happens to a group of people when they have to go through a really major shock of dramatically losing the existing sources of energy and radically convert their economy to adapt.
Right. And all this, you know, for Cuba also, it's not a free market economy, but it's a communist system. So
right.
On one hand, maybe it's easier because there are some decisions that are centrally made and implemented. But on the other hand, it's very hard to turn profit where profit is frowned upon. So,
well, one of the things that you see in this that I love to see in these sort of shock movies, and I want to mention one other, The Take, is when this happens, when a shocking change hits, when economic pain is like this, you need to just do whatever you can today. And, you know, it's a matter of literally inching forward and creating what you can with what you've got before you. And, you know, and there's nothing more important than to start doing than grow food.
Right. It's a survival mode. Yes.
Right. So you go into survival mode. I used to have a deputy at HUD that I always quote, who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. And what you can see is the people who make it through this process are the people who just start taking whatever actions they can take, which usually organize around growing food.
Mm-hmm.
I keep quoting one of our great subscribers who, at the beginning of last year, I persuaded her to limit her attention to the presidential elections to 10 hours or less. And spend the whole year instead building a huge greenhouse, which she did. And when the presidential election was over, I called her and I said, you know, I just want to congratulate you because now you have a beautiful greenhouse. And you're not upset.
Exactly. I think this is a piece of advice that can be always applied. It's like spend less time on things that are really... not immediate, and do something sensible for yourself, your family, especially yourself, you know.
Well, but I think the more you do, what this shows is a group of people who, as they do whatever they need to do to, you know, to produce resilience for themselves, the thing that makes economic sense is building income, doing things that are useful for everybody around them. And
right.
Yeah, there's a definite civilization depends on being useful to each other. And you kind of see that. Anyway, so it's a bit of an obscure documentary, but it's very useful in that respect. And there's all sorts of ideology about peak oil or Cuba that I don't get into and I don't really care about. Another one I just wanted to mention in this vein was one made by Naomi Klein and her husband called The Take, about the shock doctrine treatment by the IMF of Argentina. And then how the workers in Buenos Aires decided to just reclaim control of a plant that had been closed and to go back to work. And it has a very, you know, it shows you the ugliness of the IMF shock doctrine kind of treatment, which was done throughout Latin America throughout the 1990s and 2000s. It's part of sort of engineering central control of the economy and... you know, and watching what happened in Argentina and some of the other places in South America is a very instructive example. Another example we always have on the Solari Report is the Ann Williamson's description of what happened in the Soviet Union after the wall came down. That's and it happened in numerous Eastern European countries. But the rape of Russia is a very famous example. And The Take is an example of some of the Latin American cases. So it's the kind of gut-wrenching economic pain that forces people to sort of do whatever they have to do to make things work today.
Right, and this is also an example of an economic pain that is caused by the interconnection or globalization, whatever we call it, of countries, right?
Well, it's not just that.
The problem for Argentina is because they have any foreign debt, right? I mean, it's not the only problem that they have, but it's one of them, which is why this factory was closed, right?
What happened in Argentina was war by economic means. This was war by economic means. Because remember, you know, one way to take over a country is you pull their credit, let it crash, then you pick up the pieces cheap. So it's a dump and pump.
And the economic hitman, right, story.
Exactly. The Argentina story is a story, I mean, the Cuba story is a story of a collapse, which is because of what happened in the Soviet Union. So Cuba isn't taking a direct economic hit. They're just suffering the consequences of a major change. The Take is a story about economic war and the economic hitman taking a place down and what the workers do to respond.
Right. Yeah, these are actually fascinating stories of the 20th century geopolitics. I want to swing back to kind of the feature offering and the one that is pretty well known to most of the listeners and viewers all over the world, which is The Crown. Everybody obviously gets very excited, not everybody, but the viewers get excited about, you know, the intrigues of the Royal House of Windsor and the costumes and the jewels and whatever. But especially the first season is dealing with the moment when Queen Elizabeth has been settled on the English throne in the period that sees an extremely rapid change of status of the kingdom that she rules, because Great Britain is losing one colony in either Africa or Asia after another very rapidly, and the empire is being kind of chopped up into smaller and smaller pieces, so that within a decade the so-called British Empire is no more. It is basically the Great Britain and a few other countries loosely connected in so-called Commonwealth, but the British Empire that maybe her father or her, you know, any of her predecessors has ruled is no more. This is obviously shown through the very entertaining story of the family and their, you know, marriages and births and ups and downs. But you see it in the background when she's either paying a royal visit or where something is happening in her conversations with her prime ministers that keep changing all the time. And this is obviously a classic example of a major economic change in reverse, as much as in Once Upon a Time in China, we see it from the Chinese point of view of what happens when the colonialists come in and try to take over. Here we are seeing the reverse from the British point of view of what happens when the country is losing the sources of land, revenue and wealth and political power that is just extremely rapid, and it's literally within a decade. So for me, when I was watching all those beautiful costumes and jewels, it was fascinating to watch something that is fairly recent history. Not that I would have witnessed it, but it's very recent. So it is fascinating. It must have been a tremendous economic pain to live in England in the 1950s and just open your newspaper in the morning and read about one more pieces of empire falling apart.
Although what's interesting is our movie of the week next week on the Solari Report is one we've done before. It's a documentary called The Spider's Web. Uh-huh. And just as when the Roman army pulled back, they left a church full of endowments and diplomatic immunity and freedom from tax behind. So a real sort of syndicate operation. The British army, when all those colonies fell, what they did is they converted their global empire into basically offshore tax havens and literally turned from a colonial powerhouse to a global financial powerhouse.
Well, I don't blame them. I mean, it's a smart thing to do. It's maybe not the greatest to the advantage of other people, but for the British Empire, it was a smart thing to do, right?
Right.
If you cannot hold on to land, then just hold on to something intangible and equally valuable.
It's funny, when you sit down and read the financials for Australia, New Zealand, and the Commonwealth, what you realize is, you know, the royal family is basically in charge of managing this incredible, highly leveraged tail of equity. And you're talking about phenomenal global financial interests.
Well,
It's a real empire. And I, believe it or not, I've watched The Whole Crown, and I found it fascinating. You know, Peggy Noonan attacked it for being inaccurate historically, but I thought it showed an incredible, it gave you a feel of what it was like to live through all that economic change and what a job it was. The other thing I like about it is it makes it clear how difficult it is to govern.
Yes.
You know, people talk about, yeah, it's very, very difficult to govern. And you see what a difficult job it is. So, and of course, there's a wonderful scene where Winston Churchill dies and then the next prime minister quits. And the queen just says, she gets furious because she can't quit. Mm-hmm. You know, so they make a mess and die, or they make a mess and quit. And she stands up, she's so frustrated, and she says, "What a confederacy of quitters."
Right, you know, she knows that she cannot quit, and also she cannot really, I mean, she can advise, but she cannot really, you know, it's a constitutional monarchy or whatever, so she doesn't have the real power. I mean, she can influence, but she doesn't have the real power, so it must be an extremely frustrating role. But the very fact, I agree with you, the crown is, you know, everybody enjoys the, you know, the royal stories. But it is not a bad show at all. It does show, you know, during the Thatcher period, during the post-war period, it shows all the geopolitics that, you know, that is happening somewhere in the background. It's not in your face because it's not a kind of a show. It's done the right way, but the echoes, you know, reverberate in that palace. You know, they're not just showing her that she's meeting with Margaret Thatcher and talking about flowers. There's a lot going on there.
Right.
So the critics maybe not get it.
I think the queen is exceptionally powerful, but she has to be very, very careful about how it interacts with the civil government. You see that. You see that. So to me, it's fascinating. And, you know, I'm with you. It absolutely shows what it's like to live through cycles of economic pain and economic change.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, as I said at the beginning, we're just highlighting a few movies that speak to the subject. Let me just read the list of a few other movies that are in our main list that is part of the full story that is in the quarterly wrap. We have on that list Lawrence of Arabia, which would be talking about the Arab countries during the First World War. 1900, Onnovocento, which is Bernardo Bertolucci's story about fascists versus communists. The Last Emperor, which is talking about the last emperor in China. Danton, which talks about the French Revolution. Platoon, which talks about Vietnam War. Glory, that talks about the American Civil War. A Man for All Seasons, which talks about Henry VIII and he's taking over the church lands. And maybe you can talk about a few documentaries that we have on that list as well.
Well, I wanted to mention Reds because one of the things I try and get, you know, there's a very Bolshevik flavor about what's going on in America right now. So I always tell them I want them to read 200 Years Together by Solzhenitsyn about the Bolsheviks taking over Russia. And Reds is about that period. And I think, you know, Russia has lived through gut-wrenching changes, both 1917, of course, different times under Stalin, and then the rape of Russia, and of course, World War II. So I always find the Russian example very, very interesting. So we talked.
It is, and I would highly recommend to anybody who is using the word Marxism or socialist or Stalinist in the contemporary articles to read something about either of those things, because it just makes, you know, I don't do politics, but it makes me laugh hysterically when I hear the 20-year-olds using the word Marxism when they are trying to describe something in the Western society. And it's just, it is like, it's so funny. It's just, these people have no clue what they are talking about. So, yes, I think it might be, and also to understand anything about the geopolitics of modern Russia, you know, the Putin Russia, it might be a good idea for someone to read Solzhenitsyn or Dostoevsky, to start yes. with. yes. Or watch a movie like Reds, you know, just for the hell of it, maybe just to learn a little bit what it means.
To hear how lucky we are.
Yes.
Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy is one you've listed that is a PBS documentary. I have a copy back in Hickory Valley. It's sort of globalism from the globalist point of view, but it's got a lot of interesting footage. Again, it skims, like many documentaries, it has to skim the surface. Another one you mentioned, which I really like, another one I have, is Floored, about the Chicago commodities market and trading pits going from, you know, from an open market pit to basically an electronic market, which is, you know, what we're seeing all around the world. And then really a marvelous one, I think, is The Emperor's New Clothes, which is a British documentary about the inequalities coming out of the financial crisis. And I have to say the British economy has the most, you know, America has the worst inequality, but there's something about the way the Brits do it, which is so gut-wrenching. And you see, you know, sort of some of the very fraudulent, horrible things the banks were doing. Anyway, so not the cheeriest one on your list.
No, but... you know, the changes of tremendous changes in the political power or and the subsequent economic consequences are always gut-wrenching, which is why we named that segment using the word pain, right?
Right.
But at the same time, you know, we try to go for some movies that are entertaining as an entertainment. You know, we put the Queen Margot, which is talking about the French period of the Protestant persecution, if we like. We put the Pearl Harbor, which obviously is a movie about what happened to Japan when they made this decision to strangely fly over the Pacific for thousands of miles and invade a country much bigger than Japan, which was maybe not the best decision for the country, even though they ended up being the super economic power, because after the war, instead of spending the money on the military and expansion, they were spending it in-house, so to speak, on perfecting what they did the best, meaning the invention and economic growth. We have Apocalypto, just because it's an amazing movie, but also it's a movie where it shows in this most chilling scene at the end when all this stuff is going internally within the Mayan Empire, and then suddenly the ships show up on the horizon, and little that the continent knows, within 50 years, the entire continent is going to be transformed into something completely different. The change of ownership is basically the North and South and Central America.
Right.
That's how much of the change of ownership happens.
Right.
So the list is long, and we highly recommend for the subscribers at least to access it to enjoy various suggestions. I want to point out that you know what we have just done again, which is, well, you say it. What have we done?
We've wasted a perfectly good hour
of listeners' time, yes, by musing about movies. But we hope that there are some suggestions that maybe will give... ideas for late night streaming for the listeners. And we're wishing everybody that they do not live through the times of revolutions and economic pain, because as we can see from those movies, they are not fun.
What is it, the saying that the Chinese character for crisis is also for opportunity, something like that?
Not entirely.
Okay.
But it sounds good. Not entirely, but that's all right. I would say that, well, yes, but this is the glass half full, half empty. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, yes, there are some people who gain, but they are not necessarily the ones who have entered into the risk situation. So, you know, from the individual point of view, it's a little bit less optimistic.
Right.
Okay, so this is our list for the segment on economic pain in movies. And we hope that everybody has enjoyed themselves. And I thank you very much for your suggestions and for talking to me.
Nina, it's always a pleasure. You have a wonderful evening.
You too. Thank you. Bye.